Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be talking with Charles Chamberlain, whose new book is New Orleans, A Concise History of an Exceptional City. Charles Chamberlain is an adjunct professor of history at the University of New Orleans, specializing in the histories and music and cultures of Louisiana. He was an historian at the Louisiana State Museum for 10 years and worked as a tour guide for 10 years with his company, Historia. His new book is New Orleans, A Concise History of an Exceptional City. Charles Chamberlain, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you, Susan. It's an honor to be here. I appreciate it.
Now, what a useful book this is. It's a one-volume history that really touches on so much of New Orleans' complicated, long history. But, you know, undertaking a one-volume history seems almost as daunting as undertaking a much longer one, given the richness of the material. You know what I mean?
Yes, of course. It was a challenge to compress all of that long history into the 300 pages that it is.
Tell me about your process. How did you do that?
Well, first of all, over the years, people had suggested that I write this book. It actually wasn't my idea. I didn't, you know, think, oh, there needs to be a book like this. But as people pointed out, I said, well, yeah, sure, there does need to be a readable but scholarly, comprehensive history of New Orleans. And so teaching New Orleans history at UNO, I already had kind of the specifics mm-hmm. outlined in terms of how I would approach it. And also being a historian at the Louisiana State Museum and a tour guide, I also kind of knew what subjects people were interested in and what really they gravitated towards and, you know, basically what kind of turned their lights on. So what I did is I sat down and just wrote it basically in about a year. And in my mind, the voice that I was using, I was orienting it towards as if I were giving a tour mm-hmm. or maybe teaching my class at UNO. So I wanted to direct it towards a real general audience and also make it readable and entertaining as well.
Talk about being a tour guide. It sounds to me like you wrote the book you needed to read. You know what I mean?
So talk
a little bit about being a tour guide and the sorts of questions people asked and how that informed this.
Yeah, well, before I was a licensed tour guide with the city of New Orleans, I used to give tours of the Cabildo, you know, as the historian for the Louisiana State Museum. And the Cabildo at that time covered pre-colonial history all the way to about the turn of the century, 1900. And so I kind of had in place the parameters of the stories that people were interested in. And then as a tour guide, of course, through all the years, what has really helped in guiding my approach to what I think people are interested in is people ask questions all the time. And sometimes you see the same questions repeated, you know, what is mm-hmm. Creole? Or, you know, why is the city exceptional? You know, some of these basic questions. But in many cases also, you know, I didn't know the answer and I would be honest with them. And then I would go back and research that. And so I learned a lot from the guests along the way. And so over time, I really kind of understood really what were the important stories for people who were visiting or even for locals. And so that's kind of what I tried to focus on. And also in the book, I really tried to focus on the stories as represented through specific personalities. And as a historian, I always believe that when you personify history through a personal story, it really brings it to life and makes it much more impactful in terms of the way people engage in history. So that's really what I tried to do.
Well, talk a little bit about the life of a museum historian, because that seems to me that like a lot of fun.
It was a lot of fun. So, oh gosh, when I started the State Museum, I worked there from 2002 to 2012. Basically, you're given exhibits to curate, and so you have to come up with the objects which are generally going to be in the collection, and you can sometimes approach other institutions. You know, the Louisiana State Museum would work with the Historic New Orleans Collection or other museums regionally, and then you build stories around those objects. And then you develop a larger thematic story within the exhibit. So from that, I really immersed myself deeply in Louisiana history. And then on the side, when people would be in town and maybe they'd ask for a special tour, I would go over to the Cabildo and give an hour to an hour and a half long tour of the Cabildo. And so that's really kind of what started me in this tourism and storytelling aspect of New Orleans history.
Now, you did do some things that really distinguish this book from other histories, and I think these are very useful things. Every chapter for each time period includes a guide to the built environment, historical sites that are of relevance. And that's really a lot of fun to look at. And I think we're really lucky that so much of the built environment of our history survives, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. New Orleans is incredible in terms of the architectural heritage that we have and the landscape. And, you know, especially compared to other cities, the amount of the density of architecture that the city has maintained really reflects, I believe, the city's value of its history and the fact that the residents treasure that history. And it also attracts people from the outside who also value that greatly, because so many other American cities have torn down their historic neighborhoods or their city center, whatever the case may be. And, you know, especially I look at Jackson Square, and I've had many visitors from Europe and Latin America come and stand there, and they're saying, gosh, you know, this does not feel like the United States. It's just incredible how the vision you have in that square is now, what, 175 years old, essentially, and it really reflects the commitment to preservation that the city has. And so, as you mentioned, in each chapter, I include a list of historical sites. Part of that is my idea that one must experience the city by visiting the sites themselves. And so the book is, you know, encourages the experience of visiting the actual sites. And as well, I want people to experience the lifestyle through the recipes that I include in each chapter as well.
Well, what are some of your favorite places? What are some of the places you make sure to include for people?
Well, I think, of course, Jackson Square, as I mentioned, is one of my favorite places. To me, one of the most sacred spots is the Bayou and also Bayou Road. You know, that's really kind of the oldest documented site. And so for people who don't know, Bayou Road is the oldest route or trail in the city, and it's the portage that the indigenous people use to connect Bayou St. John to the river. And it's also the trail that Iberville, when he first came upon the site, which would be the site that developed as New Orleans, he took that from Bayou St. John to the river. And there he saw that there had been a site that was cleared by the Quinnipiac Indians as a village probably 20 years before he was arriving. So, you know, maybe in the 1680s, the Quinnipiac had lived there. So the French Quarter itself, I think, is also a very important site. So I'll just kind of leave it at that. I mean, there's so many cool areas around the city. I love the natural environment of the bayou and the river. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, you know, working in the French Quarter, and you can walk around any neighborhood, you know, several times, and you never get tired of all the little architectural details. So it's such a magical city in terms of the little details that emerge through place and architecture.
Well, tell us a little bit about those recipes that you've chosen, because you've chosen a particular recipe for every era and for a particular reason.
That's right. Well, I noticed that in giving tours that people always connected to food, and also in my class at UNO, people always connect to food. It's one of the really the grounding subjects that often unites most people. And, you know, I mean, it's just a subject where you can throw out a question, you know, do you add tomatoes to jambalaya, or how long do you cook a roux, or do you add potato salad to gumbo? You know, any number of questions that will get people really animated. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to include food as central to the history of the city. So just as an example, Chapter 1, which deals with pre-colonialism, I include the recipe for corn moksu, which of course has indigenous roots and it's now kind of identified as a Cajun dish, but it has very indigenous roots. It's a dish that many people really love. And another dish would be from Chapter 1, the French period, which is jambalaya, which basically food historians trace back to Western Africa, Senegal region, which has a strong, strong, long rice tradition. So tibagine is their traditional rice dish, which is also similar to Spanish paella. Another favorite dish I have is Creole cobillon from the American period as really a metaphor for the creolization of a traditional French dish, cobillon, which is kind of a fish stew, but then the way it adapts to New Orleans in terms of spices and local ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
And then another, I think, fantastic dish, of course, is the classic red beans and rice, which I use as the recipe for the early 20th century and really drawing on the experiences of Louis Armstrong and his love for that dish. The fact that it could be made with very simple ingredients and really taste amazing. And it's kind of funny, but after Katrina, I'm sure you had this experience, you know, many people were stranded outside New Orleans and they'd say, gosh, I can't find camellia red beans or I can't find Leidenheimer's French bread or D&D sausage to make my red beans. So it really became a touchstone for many New Orleans.
Now, I have to ask, in the tradition of, you know, a reader of cookbooks, did you cook all these recipes and try them out?
Yeah, I've cooked many of them many times.
Okay, just checking. Because that's a way to get into trouble, you know. I mean,
of course. No, you have to do that.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Charles Chamberlain, whose new book is New Orleans, A Concise History of an Exceptional City. Now, one of the things I'd love for you to talk a bit about is a friend of mine once said that New Orleans is a city that's always in conversation with itself. Always trying to define itself. Is it an exceptional city? Is it an indispensable city? Is it a resilient city? What are some of those currents that you think about in this book?
Well, of course, exceptionalism
is right there in the title.
Right. So it's right there in the title. And honestly, I wanted to raise the question rather than make a statement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it makes an interesting title, but really in the introduction, I raised the question, isn't it an exceptional city? And, you know, this is a conversation you could start at any dinner party and have people go on for hours and hours. And indeed, many of my friends, my other scholarly friends, have written me and said, oh, gosh, I can't believe you dared to write that as your title. And so it's an ongoing conversation. My personal feeling is that, as I basically convey in the introduction, that New Orleans can be considered exceptional within the United States, but in the larger Creole world of the Caribbean and Latin America and the larger Atlantic Creole world, it shares many, many similarities that are all different from kind of the Anglo-American United States. And so it kind of cuts both ways. But I think it's a great topic to constantly discuss because it will never end in terms of that discussion. And in terms of resiliency, I mean, you know, the history speaks for itself. New Orleans has been through so much in terms of the floods and the hurricanes and the yellow fever epidemics and the war assaults and the fires as well. And, you know, even economic challenges that continue to face the city. People still are drawn to the land, the specific location, and the specialness of that location. So it's such a unique location, and I've heard this from so many people as I raise this question, that, you know, I raise the question at the end, is it possible to even think about transferring our local culture to other locations as, you know, we face whatever challenges, whether it's climate change or economic challenges? Many people have told me, no, this location is so special that it would be hard to relocate any of our traditions elsewhere. But this is a challenge facing many other cultures around the world in terms of climate and culture. And so this is a huge issue that New Orleans faces along with many other communities around the world.
Another thing I'd like to hear you talk about is some of the currents in historical research about the city that have evolved over your lifetime that informed this writing. For example, I think maybe when I moved to New Orleans many, many years ago, a person writing this book might not have started with Bulbancha, for example.
Yeah.
You know? So talk about the currents in historical research and writing that have fed this book and nourished it.
Well, I mean, I was really informed in writing that chapter by, you know, friends and colleagues in the indigenous scholarly community, the activist community, who really wanted to make that point. And I agreed with them that that should be a major part of the location's history. And I don't say the city's history, but the location's history, because it goes beyond the history of the city. And that came about in 2018 when the city was celebrating the tricentennial. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a number of indigenous activists and scholars said, hey, no, Bulbancha is still a place. And many people in the city had never heard of the idea of Bulbancha.
Right.
Which is the indigenous, it's a Choctaw term for the location of New Orleans, the basically this region of the area south of Lake Pontchartrain, which means the place of many languages. And the fact that it's a cultural crossroads and a trade crossroads where the Mississippi River and the Gulf Coast converge. So I definitely was very influenced by that, particularly scholarly awareness. Also, the changes that have come about in terms of the interpretation of slavery or African-American culture or the history of free persons of color, the way that has really evolved over the last 20 years. And especially in the tourism industry, we've seen a big change in the way those subjects also have changed. And this also expands to, you know, the interpretation of the 11 Sicilians that were hung or lynched in 1891. A lot of these subjects were not talked about in terms of tourism stories or subjects. And so now I find that tourists are much more open to those stories. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, of course, a lot of tourists come. They want to hear the ghost stories and take their go cup on the streets of New Orleans at night. But what I find is that the audience really appreciates the true history. And this is reflected also, I think, in the popularity of a place like the Whitney Plantation, Museum in Wallace, Louisiana. Mm-hmm. And the popularity of that really reflects the thirst for that knowledge and that history that many people have, whether tourists or locals, or whatever it is. And so I think it's important to really include all of that history. And I hope that has informed the book overall.
And you've got a lot of information in here about immigrant populations, which are so interesting.
Yes. And, you know, we're a city built on immigrants from the very beginning. you know, in the antebellum period, the French, the Irish, and the German all contributed. And even in the period of slavery, forced immigration, including French people and African people, also informed a large part of the history. After the American Civil War, there was another massive immigration of people from the Mediterranean basin and Eastern Europe. And then, of course, in the 20th century, we have large-scale immigration from, you know, Vietnam and Latin America and even the Middle East. And so all of it comes together in this process of the term creolization, which is essentially people adapting to a new culture and then creating a new culture, which is the story of the city in many ways.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Charles Chamberlain, whose new book is New Orleans, A Concise History of an Exceptional City. I'm curious to know what your favorite historical period is.
My favorite historical period actually is probably the Spanish period. I love it for a number of reasons. The city develops as more of a sophisticated urban community. It also is a time period in which African dance and music really comes to fore in the public eye. The free person of color community grows. And really, I think the biggest legacy of that period for many people is the architecture that emerged from the fire, the mm-hmm. fires of 1788 and 1794, in which the French Quarter was rebuilt in a Spanish style with brick structures, tile roofs, courtyards, and patios. And so that really, I think, informs the old world charm of the French Quarter and what people really find attractive. And then there's so many interesting characters from that time period as well. I really think from that time period, say Père Antoine.
Oh, talk about him. He really comes to life in this book. I kept thinking, what a novel this guy would be.
I know. I mean, gosh, I mean, that would be a whole book in itself.
I know. So tell us about him.
Well, I just love him because he's a metaphor for the city. And, you know, I find that in terms of characterizing the city, it's often depicted as one that's a city of decadence and debauchery. But really, I find historically that the city also has a side to it that is very pious and spiritual. Mm-hmm. And so I think his experiences represent both of those. He was actually shipped to New Orleans by the Catholic Church to enforce the Spanish Inquisition, which would basically be a job to enforce moral strictness of the Catholic Church. And of course, anyone can imagine trying to do that in New Orleans would be an impossible task. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the Spanish crown said, no, we don't want to enforce the Spanish Inquisition because it's going to discourage immigrants who we really, really need. And so Père Antoine is known as generally a very tolerant Catholic priest. And so I think his tolerance really reflects that side of New Orleans, the tolerant side of New Orleans, and also the spiritual side as well. And in terms of spiritualism, you know, I always say, at least up until maybe the 1990s, most neighborhoods had more churches than bars.
Oh, yeah.
Which is often not the reputation of New Orleans, but I think it's very important to point out.
Well, I've been dying to ask you about this ever since I read it, but it's probably just a hole in my own knowledge. But during the fire, when he wouldn't ring the church bells to warn people, did he ever face any consequences for that?
Well, that was essentially upholding Catholic doctrine. I don't think he faced any consequences in terms of destruction of property. And I say in the book that the fire, you know, occurred on a March day and in a city where you would put out a fire with buckets and it was windy. It was known as a very windy day. That would be an impossible task to try to fight that fire. So I think he was probably praised for at least saving the archives of the St. Louis Church at the time. Oh. And I've heard stories that he literally threw them out the window to save them. And so I think he was probably praised for that. And in the end, nothing came of his actions on that day. And then the city rebuilt, of course, in a style that really reflected more of that Spanish Andalusian style. And I will say that when I was first historian at the Louisiana State Museum, it was right around the time of the state bicentennial. I had to give a tour to the Spanish ambassador and the Spanish consulate. And I asked them, I said, what do y'all think is the greatest Spanish legacy in the city? And they said, the patio, the courtyard of the French Quarter. And so I'll never forget that. So we could owe it to Don Nunez, who had the altar in his house. The altar caught on fire. His house caught on fire. And then all of the upper French Quarter burned. And, of course, that established the ability for the city to rebuild in this new style.
We've been talking with Charles Chamberlain, whose new book is New Orleans, A Concise History of an Exceptional City. You can meet Charles when he appears at the Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival in March. Charles, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Susan. It's really been an honor, and I appreciate you having me on the show.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Benjamin Karp signs The Leviathan Conspiracy, Friday, January 9th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Dickens Fellowship discusses David Copperfield, chapters 28 to 37, Saturday, January 10th at 2 at the Bright Library, Metairie Park Country Day School. Vicky Saloom discusses and signs her novel, The Gathering Place, Sunday, January 11th at 5 at Garden District Bookshop. And coming up, Kamala Harris's book tour for 107 days will bring her to the Sanger Theater January 13th. Tickets are available at Eventbrite. Three New Orleans authors, Elisa Speranza, author of The Italian Prisoner, Vincent Lococo, author of The Devil's Jazz, The Haunted Chronicles of the X-Men of New Orleans, and Vicky Saloom, author of A Gathering Place, discuss their work Tuesday, January 13th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Ashley Elston discusses and signs Anatomy of an Alibi, Wednesday, January 14th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Stefan Fatsis, author of the New York Times bestseller Word Freak, discusses and signs Unabridged, The Thrill of and the Threat to the Modern Dictionary, Friday, January 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.